when he runs for president, people begged him to run for president. He said no, and that was the right thing to do. That kept you as the selfless hero. But as soon as he said, oh, okay, I'll run for president, his depictions went down the tubes the next day.
This is Preble Hall. Welcome to Preble Hall, a podcast about naval history from the United States Naval Academy Museum in Annapolis.
Welcome back to another episode. Our guest today is Professor Lori Bogle, Professor of History at the United States Naval Academy. She teaches U.S. social history, which includes military, diplomatic, and religious history. And she's been here since 1997. She earned her PhD from the University of Arkansas and is here today to discuss the turn of the century, the Spanish-American War heroes, and the POWs here at the United States Naval Academy. Lori, welcome to Preble Hall.
Well, thank you. Welcome to you.
Why did you start studying the issue of heroes during the Spanish-American War?
Well, my main topic of interest is Theodore Roosevelt, and not a biography of him, but more on how he was able to shape his public image for the American people to fit the needs of the time. And within that, of course, is him establishing himself as a hero. And so in the process of doing research on that, I came across an unusual article that I couldn't understand. And it led to this paper I wrote on the topic of Admiral Cervera as a prisoner of war.
Why is Teddy Roosevelt trying to shape his image? When does it start?
Well, that's a good question. It's one I'm struggling with. The book is not finished. I have most of all my research done. Of course, I've been saying that for a few years now.
As we all do.
Yes. My contention is that Theodore Roosevelt, a member of the elite class, his father was very politically active, and the generation before Roosevelt had decided that American politics had gotten out of hand, and that different urban bosses had taken over cities, and up to the Civil War and afterwards, that the elite had left politics of playing an active role. They played a passive role in funding things, et cetera. But there were fewer and fewer elites in political positions, especially at the state and national level.
Why was that?
It was seen as not gentlemanly to be a politician, because one of the things about 19th century culture for the elite was that you could never represent yourself in an authentic way, a non-authentic way. And so to be a politician is to present yourself as the people want you to be, and they recognize that as being a falsehood. There's been a lot of research on honor and dueling, and this kind of ties into it, believe it or not, and that one of the biggest insults you could do to a man at this in the 19th century was to pull their nose. And we have lost the meaning of that over the years.
That's really important, because the first attack on a U.S. president was on Andrew Jackson on a riverboat or steamboat, and it was by a recently dismissed U.S. naval officer, and I never understood why that was so significant. He went up and tweaked his nose.
Right, and there's a debate afterwards whether or not his fingers actually touched his nose. Because if they had touched his nose and Jackson didn't duel him, mm-hmm. it would be considered that Jackson was less than a man. The pulling the nose, and who knows where it begins, it seems like it's tied to Pinocchio somehow, believe it or not. But it was a gesture that indicated that the person pulling your nose was unmasking you. They were pulling off your mask, saying you're a liar. You're not who you represent yourself to be. And so gentlemen would defend that to their death. And I tell my class about this, and I say, you know, 19th century honor is different than today. I mean, women weren't honorable in the 19th century, but doesn't mean they weren't truthful or virtuous. But it means that they didn't have this commodity, as I say it, of honor, which means other men had to recognize that and give deference to you. But if anyone challenged that sense of masculinity, sense of citizenship even, a sense of honor, your unwillingness to put your life on the line would indicate that you were less than manly, and you would lose that commodity with other men. You would be considered less than.
You know, we have these words, these ideals, honor, courage, commitment, etc., here at the Naval Academy and other service academy, military service academies. But were they taught honor? Were they taught what it meant? For example, would they have some sort of gentlemanly class that said, well, if you tweak this person's nose, this is what happens? Or are there ideals that they are taught at a young age, formally?
Well, you're getting right at the stuff I love to talk about, which probably has less to do with this, but I love this. It's that, it was an upper class, and generally the people that went to West Point, the Naval Academy, were upper class, but mm-hmm. not all. Well, they weren't taught the old sense of honor because it was just incorporated into what a man knew, what it meant to be a man among other men. I'm not talking about the lower classes, but the upper class. What the academies did try to teach is a different code of honor, which is more representative of what we think of today. So in the old form of honor, your total loyalty was to other members of your class. And it sounds a little weird, but you could cheat on a test at West Point. That's the stories I know more about. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't considered dishonorable because it was seen as a competition among the cadets and the administration to see who could win this little battle. But if you were asked if you cheated on the test and you said, no, I didn't, but your fellow cadets knew you did, they themselves would run you out of the school because your word is your honor. And it's a little weird because one could lie mm-hmm. as long as no one's willing to challenge you. You don't lose that commodity. It's just, I know.
Did that end up happening here at the Academy? Did you look at some of the old student records of the 1800s, which show the kinds of demerits students received?
I did most of my research on the 19th century code of honor at West Point, unfortunately. I was in a joint project with another faculty member, and she looked more at the Naval Academy, but we did share our research. I can't give you an exact case, but I do know this. Of the people that dueled in the Navy in the 19th century, more midshipmen dueled than any other group. So that does seem to say that this is still true.
And there was one here. I think there's only one recorded duel between two midshipmen here on the grounds of the Naval Academy around 1853 or 54.
And there became more acceptable ways to challenge someone's honor. Fist fights, you know, different, maybe some of the class system of how you harass the lower class. Some people see that as an extension of this personal honor. So the deal is, though, I call it an exaggerated sense of personal honor within the officer corps at West Point, at the Naval Academy, out in the fleet. It's anti-professionalization. It goes against what the administration wants because they want you to come to them and have them settle disputes rather than you getting bent out of shape and you're going to prove your honor.
So they're trying to provide a more formalized structure for resolving these issues.
Right. And that's fine, but it's very hard to eradicate this older sense of honor. And I say that the Academy, even today, doesn't want to get rid of it completely. Because they want midshipmen to protect each other on one hand, but they don't want to protect them too much. The midshipmen are asked to do an impossible task. That is, know when it's okay to rat out somebody. Mm-hmm. But when you rat somebody out, all the other midshipmen are going to look at you as a traitor to their old sense of honor of being together.
Right.
And as a competition with the administration. But the administration is desperate to have their allegiance first to the administration before each other.
How does honor tie into heroic values in the late 19th century?
Well, maybe I would say that honor is another form of upper class masculinity. Lower classes did other things, you know, but they would fight things out if they had a disagreement
right.
necessarily. But so the 19th century sense of honor lends itself very well to the creation of heroes because heroes have been around forever, of course, mm-hmm. but both are about masculinity. The honor code I'm talking about is upper class masculinity. Heroes don't necessarily have to be the upper class, though, but it's the same demonstration of that elevates you in importance based on your ability to deal with other men because of what heroism you've done.
Why is heroism strictly a masculine thing? Because when you look at some of the truly more heroic figures in history, Queen Artemisia at the Battle of Salamis, you have Boudica, you have, there are other women who portray, I mean, if you're going to tie heroism with the warrior mentality, there were women warriors. Is that simply because by the 17th, 18th, 19th century, there weren't opportunities as there were, say, in more ancient times?
That's a very, really good question. I haven't studied the ancient times as much, but I would say that America is uniquely, our frontier experience has something to do with it. We're uniquely ambitious, a warrior kind of spirit.
Let's look at the...
I have never tried to connect it backwards, so...
Yeah, I just wonder if that changes over time as well.
See, I'm actually trying to answer that question about why women aren't our heroes, they're heroines. And I don't know if the... See, I don't know, but in the ancient times, was a man attached to these stories of these women in some way? Generally, they are in cultures, but I think a culture could be different than our culture.
By the outbreak of the Spanish-American War in 1898, how is heroism defined?
Heroism is much more needed. I guess it's always needed no matter what the generation is. But it seems to be, after the Civil War, there was a crisis in American masculinity in that, again, I'm talking about the elite class here. Elites overwhelmingly had hired substitutes to serve for them in the war.
And that was a problem for Teddy Roosevelt, of course,
right,
because his father had done that.
Right, and his father was a man that he loved dearly, but he was always ashamed of this fact, always. And so at the same time that elites are trying to get back into politics because they had left politics because they thought it was beneath their class prior to the Civil War, then they want to get back in politics after the Civil War because they're worried about how the masses are being controlled by uneducated men who were able to mold them using mass media at that time. And they got scared that American democracy, as they knew it, was going to be doomed. They were worried about a revolution even because of this mass culture that they didn't think had existed before. And so they're trying to get back in politics, but they have been deemed effeminate by that time, the upper class, for not having served, and their exaggerated manners, whatever. So even before the Spanish-American War, there's a movement in elite culture to go out to the frontier, like Theodore Roosevelt did. He's not the only one. To get into sports, there's a sports craze among the upper class to prove your masculinity. That's part of it.
So is this when intercollegiate sports really begins, is after the Civil War?
1880s, I'm thinking, 1890s.
So 1880s and 90s, you have here at the Academy, you have the first baseball teams, the first football teams, crew,
right,
et cetera.
Gymnastics, actually, not gymnastics, but calisthenics are started after the Civil War. You know, they're really getting into being proving one's masculinity in other ways. And it sounds a little callous the way I say that, like it's all about proving their masculinity. It isn't. I mean, it's fun to play football, you know, and people enjoy it. There's other reasons. But one reason the elites are funneling so much effort into it is that they've been deemed effeminate. And Theodore Roosevelt, from a very young age, is trying to make his body. His father even encouraged him to do that.
Because of a very sickly child.
Right.
Yeah.
And he also was trying to overcome, as he got older, his father's reputation as being effeminate. There's a lot of fascinating things I could say about this, in that Roosevelt's shame about his father not serving, even though he loved him dearly. As Roosevelt gets in politics, his father has died by then. His father's class, by opponents against Roosevelt, will call people of his father's age group by the most horrible homophobic names, etc. Then when Roosevelt, you would think Roosevelt would think that was the worst thing possible you could do, is to cast a negative kind of stereotype upon an elite man who you're running against in politics. He himself, in the 1880s, 1890s, calls people that had associated with his dad by the same homophobic kind of slurs and stuff. So there's a lot of, a psychologist could have a lot to do with this. But in any case, the straight, simple story is that there was a need for elite men to prove to the voters, who are now not as easily swayed as they thought they would be in the past by their class and education. The voters are looking for more of a heroic kind of image of a man, who, a self-made man. they started calling people like Roosevelt dudes, and dudes was a negative term that meant you were effeminate. And Roosevelt and his generation, so the generation after his father, are able to take that term and turn it upside down and make it a masculine term. And the way they do it is they volunteer in droves for the Spanish-American War, even before that, doing different masculine things.
So war becomes the crucible for confirming the issues of honor and heroism.
And the right to rule others, because these dudes are looking for political office.
So for it wasn't just Theodore Roosevelt who's going to the Spanish-American War to pursue politics. And we know that he was definitely interested in politics well before.
And that's what hurts his hero status.
Why?
I know, it sounds a little strange. So we got all these competing things going on. It's the dudes, as we'll call them, are wanting to go to war because they're patriotic too. I don't mean to take that away.
I have to ask, are these sons of industry who are going off to the Spanish-American War?
Oh, some are, but at the very same time, there's this division between old wealth and new wealth, mm-hmm. and his father's generation was trying to exclude the new wealth from their social circles. But about the time Roosevelt's being born, they realize that they are losing out politically completely because they're dividing themselves even. So they meld the two classes, old and new wealth, into something I call the new governing elite, where you have to look the other way. You may not like it that guy didn't go to Harvard, but you're going to go ahead and start sending the sons of those people to Harvard so that you can have this more unified class to be a voting group that can take leadership positions, and they work together to try to help each other get to leadership positions.
Are the elites advancing the cause for the war, the reasons to get us into the war with Spain?
You ask the best questions, because I am.
You know, it's really nice to actually ask the questions. You know, this is a lot more fun and a lot easier.
I try to break down another article I did. It's a generational divide between, let's say, Roosevelt's father and Roosevelt's generation. So the older elites and the younger elites. The older elites were, I can't say any group is unified completely, but they were more anti-imperialism than the newer elites. And having said that, I'm sure there's some younger elites that were against it. But overall, the younger elites, see this as their opportunity to prove their masculinity. But they're already more pro-military. You remember the older elites hadn't served in the Civil War necessarily.
Right.
And even if they had, they saw how horrible the Civil War was, right? And so when Theodore Roosevelt's generation, they just saw that, you know, Roosevelt was seven, you know, I don't know what year the war that he was seven, but in that age range, he just saw his father being gone. And his father didn't serve, but he was on this allotment. I'm getting the name a little bit wrong, but allotment's in it. An allotment commission where he went to the front lines and put his life in danger, serious danger, and tried to get the soldiers to sign up to send some of their money home to their families, to get that system going. And I've always wondered about this. Why didn't Roosevelt talk about his father and say, yeah, he didn't serve, but he voluntarily put his life on the line without a weapon in his hand? He never does it. And you go, because Roosevelt gets everything wrapped around military service is your definition of masculinity and citizenship.
And for that, you need a weapon. Does it come down to that? Is that you are, whether it's the ancient times where if you're a warrior, you have a spear, a trident, or a sword. In modern era, it's a firearm. But if you go to war without a weapon, are you seen as less than the ideal of a warrior?
And the reason I say wow is I'm just finishing up my summer course, Social Cultural Military History for American Military History. And it's the theme of the whole course. Can any outgroup ever get full citizenship rights, meaning they are full citizens, but are they accorded the same equality and rights if they don't have the ability to serve in combat?
Well, because I almost think about the Merchant Marine during World War II, and you think of what they went through during the Battle of the Atlantic. Their ships are being attacked. Their ships are being sunk. So many merchant mariners were lost in the Atlantic.
It doesn't matter.
But they are viewed differently
yep.
in terms of benefits from the government or et cetera. Be, because they weren't on a ship with weapons. Well, they had some weapons. I shouldn't say that they were.
The Navy is always a little suspect in that regard,
right,
then,
right?
Because it's the hand-to-hand combat. Mm-hmm. And if you think about it, it goes back to this sense of honor, this raw masculinity. And what gave that commodity to you was your willingness to stand in the line of fire. And so without putting yourself into facing your enemy head on, you were seen as less than. Not that you were less than a man necessarily, but the man that did that was more than. So in the class I teach, it's the until blacks were accorded a role fully in combat, they were kept back more. I mean, it's not perfect still, but the ability to be integrated fully into a combat unit, and no question about that, sort of elevates your status. So we're ending in the course with a discussion about women. And I have been amazed by the transition in my student body from when I started in 97 to today. Today, my midshipmen have female company officers, some of them, and they don't seem to have any qualms whatsoever about women serving in combat. Well, maybe they're not telling me, I don't know, but they have told me before when I was in class that they were so against this. Oh, this is horrible. This is going to cheapen our experience even here. And it's just been this complete turnaround. And I think it is because women are serving in combat. Whether it's by design or not, if you're sent out to be in charge of a convoy supply and you're attacked, you have to fight. You have to be able to fight. And there's been this appreciation that women are putting their lives on the line. And I don't know if anyone thinks it out directly, but there seems to be a correlation with the ability to, the willingness to put your life on the line.
And the fact that over the past 20 years, you have had women who have been pilots who have been shot down.
Absolutely.
You have had infantry officers killed in action. There were, early in the Iraq war, for example, there was a young private who had been captured by the Iraqis, and her story and those of her unit were told over the media. So maybe part of that is simply familiarity.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
Experiences, that shared experiences that they're having.
All right, not every woman has to serve in combat for women to get more, it sounds so wrong to say respect as far as being more equal mm-hmm. with men. But your class has to be represented at least in that role.
So by the beginning of the Spanish-American War, would you suggest that the Navy culture and the Army culture were the same or similar in terms of this code of honor and this goal to accomplish something that their fathers or grandfathers had not done or had looked differently? Rephrase that. Because of how the older generation, as you said, was not enamored of this more imperial nature of the Spanish-American War. Was there a difference between the services themselves?
Between the Army and the Navy?
Right.
And I'm going to go out on a limb here because I haven't looked at all the figures, but from what I have read in my memory, the Navy attracted more upper class than the Army did. The Navy was considered more aristocratic, meaning officer corps, not the rank and file.
Why was that?
It goes well in European culture. It was always that way. It's a little different in America, but the first son would get the land, right? The second son would become a military officer of some kind. It took more money to go into the Royal Navy, if we're talking about Britain, because you had to supply all your equipment, et cetera. It was cheaper to go into the Army as an officer in training. And so it tended to be that the wealthier went to the Navy because they associated with others of their class. That is Europe. And in America, I can't give you all the answers. That tradition carries over somewhat, but it's this idea that in the Army, you maybe go out fighting Indians, right? That's mostly what people in the Army did at first. But in the Navy, you represented your country abroad. You were diplomats. It was more attractive, I'm out on a limb here, to the upper class to send their sons to be officers in the Navy than it was for the Army. But that's not absolute. There are all classes that become naval officers. But there seem to be, if not fully truthful in saying that, there seem to be the public image anyway, that the Navy was more aristocratic. Whether how true that is debatable.
And you also had this divide, it seems, in the 19th century because, as you mentioned, the Army was more of a constabulary force on the frontier. They were securing lands for the United States, whereas you had the Navy, which was going out not conquering other lands.
Throughout
most of the 19th century.
Right.
They were engaging in commercial enterprises. You had officers who would take some time off to run a company and be merchant mariners, if you will. But you had a different viewpoint of the world. They were going out around the world, and it seemed like they had a better understanding of the world. And because of that, they were more interested in engaging in diplomacy and commercial interests because of the necessity. When you're on a ship in, say, 1850 or 1880, you rely heavily on other countries for water, fuel,
right,
coal or whatever, or materials in the pre-steam age. Whereas if you're an Army officer, you are pretty much living off the land and you don't have to necessarily rely on commercial interests.
Right. And what's fascinating is, so the Navy is very active in government work, right? They're helping run the government in essence by being diplomats, even to the point of transporting notable people across to their diplomatic station. They become involved in the diplomatic relations. So you would think the Navy would be more political in America, but it's the opposite, because the Army officers who are here, they have to they appeal to their local state. They still see themselves as a representative of their state, where naval officers tend to not. They see themselves as representative of the nation. And they're the ones that are seeking political office more. And that's why, you know, some people argue, you know, why did more Army officers secede during the Civil War? They do see themselves as citizens of the states. Mm-hmm. Naval officers, some did, but majority did not. They stayed with the Union. Stayed with the Union. They see themselves more as citizens of the nation.
I'm glad you answered that, because the question we chatted before the podcast, and I said, there's going to be a question I'm going to ask you. I'm not going to tell you.
Is that it?
My question has always been, why is it that you see so many Army officers who have become president or in other high political positions, but you don't see the Navy? In fact, I had an article in War on the Rocks earlier this year that traced all the presidents and vice presidents, what rank they held, if any. And you see that there were no presidents with Navy backgrounds except after World War II, where you had a series of presidents, you know, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, Ford,
Carter. Yeah, things had changed by then.
George Herbert Walker Bush. But they're all junior officers.
Right.
You have no captains or admirals who have become president, unlike generals throughout throughout the 19th century and one or two in the 20th century.
I think I can answer it. And that is, our military tradition right from the beginning has been of a citizen soldier concept, and I'm talking about elites again here, that one will stop their economic pursuits in time of emergency and go serve their country. But when that emergency's over, you go back home, right? Because you don't want to stay in the military too long, because it corrupts your values and your ability to be democratic, et cetera. So again, too simplistic to state it this way, but the Army attracted men of ambition who some wanted to stay in the Army forever, but the Army didn't have much in the 19th century for them to do. So it was a stepping stone, proving themselves as citizen soldiers to go into politics. In fact, if you hadn't served in a war, it was hard to get elected. The Navy attracts people that are, again, I'm talking about officers, who are committed to the national mission. They see their job as a career. They're less likely to see it as a stepping stone to politics. They see them very active in government operations, despite the fact they're not going to go out and get elected. Of course, you could say Theodore Roosevelt was in the Army, but he also had the naval background
as well.
Right.
All right. Let's turn to your article, because that's a really good segue. Because in the abstract, for example, it says naval officers were more attractive to the public than Army officers.
Oh, yeah.
If that's the case, why didn't Navy officers take advantage of that?
They did.
To become politicians.
This is this moment in time when everything kind of switches, and that is the American public. There's a Napoleon craze right before the Spanish-American War.
Is that because of the architecture? I mean, even here at the Naval Academy, we have the Beaux-Arts architecture. Well, that's based on the Napoleon III era in Paris, but why is there a resurgence of Napoleon?
There is this, okay, you know, we had gone through a rapid industrialization, and it seemed like the individualistic qualities that had made our country great, at least the theory that that had made us great, was disappearing, and everyone was working for a company or... And there was a longing in the American public for ambitious men that went out and conquered and made their own way. This is why Carnegie and Rockefeller almost become cult heroes themselves by their ruthlessness in becoming wealthy. And you think, well, why would the people admire that? But yet they kind of do. And so the name, it's interesting. So there's this appeal to Napoleon and Alexander the Great. Those are the two people that everyone is couching how they look at a hero by using them as examples. So when the Spanish-American War came, that's when we become imperialistic. That's when we become a global power, the start of that, right? And as that comes, the American public starts seeing the possibilities of greatness, I guess, for the country. And naval officers who have already non-political, remember they're not so political, even though they're doing political things, are dashing. They come across as being heroic by nature. And I think I write in my article something about it's how you depict a hero often. All naval heroes are depicted as standing on the battleship at the front and standing, looking forward.
Like Farragut.
Yeah.
Most of the images you see of Farragut on the USS Hartford during the Battle of Mobile Bay.
Yes.
He's up, right.
And Dewey's the same, right? And the bullets are coming by, but they never flinch. And this is so interesting, because I was reading this, I go, oh, so they never flinch. And in fact, when one naval officer doesn't like another, they'll say, I saw him flinch. And that's the biggest insult you could do, because back when dueling happened, the person that was the most honorable was not necessarily the one who won the duel. It was the one who didn't flinch in the face of death. And so these naval officers are depicted as not wanting anything for themselves. They're selfless, like George Washington, virtuous. You don't want to know anything negative about their character because you want that image. But they also are aggressive. Now, they're not being aggressive on their own behalf, so that makes it work better. They're being aggressive on behalf of the nation. And they stand in the face of death without flinching. And then, of course, without those miraculous victories at Manila Bay and Santiago, maybe this all wouldn't have come together, but it seemed like the hand of God had come down and given us this great victory. There's such a simple victories that the Army is fighting for the battles they win. They have to fight in the dirt and grime, and they're trying to win. And it's not as seemingly easy as it is when our superior naval forces are able to wipe out the Spanish forces. And the American public just says it must be because we possess all these superheroes, and they don't flinch.
And this is the first time that we have an admiral who is actually running for president after the...
Not yet.
Spanish-American War.
Right.
Never a mention
of politics.
Right.
But when the war is over and Dewey mania sweeps the nation and people are naming all their kids after George Dewey and they're crying at his presence, it's like a hero worship that's gone crazy. In fact, some newspaper writers are saying, what's happened to our country? This is... What's going on? And they look to psychologists to try to explain this frenzy of not just for Dewey, but from the other admirals at Santiago too, and a guy named Hobson, who had been involved at Santiago. It goes to Dewey's head. When he runs for president, people begged him to run for president. He said no, and that was the right thing to do. That kept you as the selfless hero. But as soon as he said, oh, okay, I'll run for president, his depictions went down the tubes the next day. He was no longer the public hero. I mean, we remember him as the big hero of the war, the big naval hero.
If he had said something akin to Sherman, but changed it. Instead, you know, Sherman famously said, if nominated, I will not accept. If if elected, I will not serve. If Dewey had changed the words and said, I do not seek the nomination or the presidency, I'm simply here to serve my country if the people so will. If he had been more humble,
yes,
if you will, do you think that would have generated more interest and support for a Dewey presidency in 1900?
Absolutely. And it's kind of a sad story. He seemed to be prepared to become a hero when the war started. Secretary of the Navy Long had actually issued a instruction to naval officers before the war started and said, if you put your life on the line to defend American battleships and our goals, we, the Navy, will work to make you a public hero. We will do our part to make sure you are. So I think Dewey understood that. And what he did was perfect at first. So people thought he was a PR genius, because after the win at Manila, very quiet, right? And he has to be there for a goodly amount of time, months and months, while they're waiting for the army to show up to kind of clean up things in Philippines, excuse me.
Yeah, he doesn't come back until, I think, late September of 1899, and he's gone through he's in the Philippines until then.
On his journey back, yeah, he has reporters with him. Almost all naval vessels had reporters, and this was done by Long in order that they could shape the news that was coming out about the Navy. And the Army just doesn't have that same ability. I mean, now we embed reporters with troops, but it was easier for the Navy to do that than the Army. And so on his journey back, everyone wants to know about him. Tell me more about Dewey. And Dewey kept quiet. He kept modest. He just didn't say anything. So everyone says he's a genius. He's humble. He comes back for this parade in New York City, which was beyond belief on how much the American public thought he was the greatest thing that had ever happened. He's humbled by that, impressed by it. And then things started to die down a little bit. So people wanted to give him a house. That's what you gave heroes in the 19th century. The public gives them houses. So he accepts the house. And then it dies down a little bit. He gets married to a Catholic woman. I'm going to say this wrong. I think she had been divorced at one point. That made it worse. And gave her the house the public had given him. He was puzzled by the public reaction to that, because I think it may have been a tax thing, why he put it in her name even. Who knows? But they were turned off by that. But then when he said, okay, I'll run for president, he's just shocked by the reaction. And they said, well, what makes you qualified to run for president? Which is a normal question you might ask somebody that wants to be president. He goes, it doesn't look like it's too hard of a job. And that was it. And then the cartoons of Dewey prior to this were of a gallant hero, never flinching. After that, he was like a sniveling, worthless individual, the cartoons.
So why is Dewey the one out of the Spanish-American War who is the naval officer most considered for politics? When you have, in Santiago, you had Schley and Sampson.
Well, Schley and Sampson weren't as PR savvy, but I don't even know if Dewey was. It just may have looked like it was. They get into an immediate argument who should get the most credit for the battle. And that is seen as not selfless, but selfish. Theodore Roosevelt is running for office. Everyone knows he wants to be governor or something. So while they see him as a hero, they can't accord him the highest level of heroism because he has a selfish or a political aspiration. It's not a criticism of him. It's just that he doesn't fall into the category of Dewey, who, again, if he had come back home immediately, maybe he wouldn't have been treated the same. But he's gone long enough, and there's so much mystery about who he is. Because this is the key thing that we haven't talked about yet. This is the time period. We've always had heroes, right? Military heroes over time. But this is the time heroes become celebrities, where mass media has gone to the point where they have celebrity news, where a celebrity can have very disgraceful attributes even, but it is famous for being famous. And so they're covered by the newspapers, and, oh, we saw Carnegie come out of this house and he had coffee on this corner, and they want those intimate details of everything the person does. So the old military hero, nobody asked those questions. This image of who that person was probably was sanitized some, and it wasn't questioned. so they could stay heroes longer. But in the Spanish-American War, the news was so immediate that they started following each one of these heroes around. And then they report, well, Samson and Schley, I know I always have trouble with that. They're not real heroes. Look at them arguing about such petty things. And Richmond Hobson, who had been on the Merrimack, he goes on a kissing tour. It wasn't by his design, but he definitely wanted to be a big hero.
I think he later becomes a congressman.
He does.
Yeah.
But it's almost like he's a pop star. He's very good looking and young. And so at one city, some girl kissed him. And so then they started lining up. And everywhere he went, he would be kiss all the girls. And I think in one place, it was like 200 girls that were lined up and kissed. And so he's called Kissing Hobson. And the public was just a little bit too uncomfortable with that as a public hero, a person that you would look up to and want to be like. And said, no, this guy's just in it for the glory. You know, so he kind of goes down. Each one of them in some way has something negative. And in Theodore Roosevelt's case, he wasn't considered the top-level hero in the beginning, but because of his political aspirations. But he remains a hero long enough without anything negative to bring that image down, that in the end, when all the other heroes have been discredited, he remains. But before that happens, Cervera gets that honor.
Well, that was going to be my next question.
Yeah.
Because now we shift to the other side of the Spanish-American War, that also has a hero, but for very different, seems like for very, very different reasons. Tell us about Pascual Cervera.
Well, he thought he was going to be the scapegoat for everything that had ever gone wrong. I would say he was not set up to be a hero for Spain in any way.
He was aware of the shortcomings of the Spanish fleet, which was out of date at that point. He knew what he was getting into when he was going to be facing a more modern U.S. fleet.
He was advocating that this not happen. There were three different fleets, if we want to call it that, that the Spanish had at the time in 1898. And Camara, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, had the home defense fleet, which I believe they had their best resources at. But and Montojo over in the Philippines, he knows he's getting ready to get clobbered. There's no way around it. Unless their shore batteries are able to prevent Dewey to come in, and he's going to lose everything. And it's almost sacrificial. And then Cervera, who had been warning the government, do not go to war with America. Our ships are in terrible shape. One of his ships even had wooden, phony guns on it to give the appearance it had guns when it didn't. I mean, it's that bad. A couple of the ships are better than others, but they're not good. He is ordered out anyway. The home government was facing a possible rebellion from the people if they didn't go to war. And so it was like, you know, you have to go to the Caribbean, you have to fight the Americans, and you're going to die. That's pretty much his message. And so,
but we'll maintain honor by going out to fight.
We will maintain honor. So he was a shrewd guy. And so as he went to every stop along his way to the Caribbean, he left letters everywhere. And the letters, I don't know who he addressed them to, probably someone in his family or government. I believe it was his family a lot of the time. But it would say, hey, I told my government that we couldn't survive this, but I will do my duty for my country. And it was some kind of variation on that in every stop of the way until he gets to Santiago and he goes in and he makes mistakes. I mean, he's shrewd on how to protect his reputation after he dies, which he's expecting. But when he goes, there was no reason that he had to go into Santiago except that he was out of coal. But he could have got out sooner. That's the theory anyway, people say, that why did you stay in there and get blockaded in by the Americans? But there was no coal there when he got there, and everyone's starving, and they don't have enough food to share with his fleet. So he's kind of stuck. And then he's sitting there going, oh, my goodness, we're all going to die.
Doesn't he save a...
Hobson is the guy.
Right.
All right. That's a really interesting story. I love too many things is the problem. But let me just say, though, that there was one... the Americans had cut the cables into Cuba, but one remained that information could go back and forth. And the message came out, no, you must go forth and fight the Americans for the honor of Spain. So when he did that, they're prepared to die when that happens. Prior to that, is when Severo's reputation changes. And what I mean by that is when he's on his way to America, the American public has been told by some sources that their fleet, the Spanish fleet, is superior to ours. And numerically, I guess it was, but not in condition. So he is depicted in American cartoons and as a dangerous enemy that's coming to destroy us, which is totally unrealistic, but nonetheless. When he gets and goes into Santiago Harbor and gets stuck there, he's depicted as a coward. And look at this cowardly guy, he won't come out and fight. Okay, while that image is going on, the Americans decide to send in a collier, if I'm saying that right?
Yeah.
Right, to sink it at the mouth of the bay in order to make it more difficult for Severo to leave, which I've always wondered about. According to Mahanian doctrine, you don't want to blockade your enemy and you want them to come out and fight. But in any case, that's what they decided to do. And so this Richmond Hobson, he volunteers, or is volunteered, as an engineer to help put the explosives on the ship and go in. So Hobson's really ambitious. And when they do it, there was supposed to be an American vessel that would come pick them up after they blew it up, but something went wrong. They're not exactly where they should be. And in fact, it is a failure if you wanted to look at it because they don't block the harbor. But Hobson and his crew are in the water and they're hiding under some wreckage. And I've always thought, did Severo plan this out this much? He looks like he's the kind of guy that might, but I can't say for sure. A rescue boat, Spanish rescue small boat, comes out to pick up the POWs. And when Hobson looks out, it's Severo himself. Why would the admiral himself be there and reaches out his hands and brings them aboard? The telling of the story changes by Hobson over time to the point where Hobson is swimming out to that boat and saying, you must do this. You know, he takes charge.
Can he get the Congressional Medal of Honor for this action?
You know,
I seem to remember a painting where he's wearing...
It sounds right to me because he becomes a big hero before Santiago Bay happens, the battle. He is the big hero. And so he's a prisoner of the Spanish. And at first, so some of our reporting of it at first was Severo's a criminal. He's torturing our prisoners or whatever. Doesn't last long because Severo then sends out a messenger to go to American fleet and say, we have your men, they're being treated well. It was a very gracious and chivalrous thing to do. So my interpretation of that, which I don't have hard facts on, is that they're playing roles. Severo knows the role he's playing. He knows he's going to lose this battle. He's showing his chivalry. And that Hobson is taking advantage of the situation. He was brave. I'm not saying he wasn't. But he keeps embellishing the story until he's this very dramatic person that's demanding Severo do this or that. But Severo and Hobson get into this personal relationship from that point on where they praise each other's chivalry. Even right before Severo's death when he's in Spain, Hobson will go visit him so that can be in the newspapers again of them saying how each one of them is wonderful. They never bring up anything unpleasant that happened. And Severo was very careful when he's back in Spain never to bring up that some Spanish prisoners have been killed by the American Navy. I'm not sure if it was Marine Corps that did it or not, but they were ordered on a ship that was taking prisoners up to America. They were the Harvard, I think it was. They were ordered in English to sit down or whatever the order was. They didn't understand the order, and so they didn't obey it immediately, and so we opened fire on them and killed some of them, which was very avoidable. It did not have to happen, but we're going to forget that. Severo's going to forget it. It's not going to be brought up because it tarnishes this mutual admiration society that begins.
Because after the Battle of Santiago, Severo and his men are defeated. He's in the water. He's brought aboard a U.S. Navy ship. And
naked.
And there's applause, right? not for his being naked, but for his heroism.
Well, I must say about the naked part, because that's what everyone cares about. Back then, you were considered naked if you were in your underwear. Mm-hmm. So he may have had his underwear on, but we'll leave that. Yeah, as soon as the Severo leaves, right, full flags and everything, like a dramatic leaving of the harbor, You could depict that as a coward, couldn't you, that he's racing away? But no, once this battle's over, we're only going to depict him as being the gallant hero that came out willing to die, because it works for us then. It works for him. It works for everybody. But all the ships of the Spanish either run aground or on fire, destroyed in some way. And he's thrown into the water. His son is with him as well. And now they have the problem of sharks in the water, plus the Cuban rebels are shooting at him from the shoreline, and they have to swim ashore. He survives that, as his son does, and the bulk of the crew, I think it was like 200 plus that died, and excess of 1,000 that survived and become prisoners of war. And so when the Americans pick him up on shore, they then take him out to a ship to surrender, to be received. And as he's going up the ladder with very little clothing on, if not completely naked, they pipe him aboard as a visiting admiral. And he's immediately, and I don't think it's so unusual when one officer surrenders to another that you treat them with chivalry or something, and you compliment their bravery. But the reporters are right there, and the American officers know that they're being recorded. And every detail about which ship he went to, who gave him some brandy, who gave him clothes, you know, so that he would be more dignified. And every point of the way in American papers is saying this wonderful Admiral Cervera, the most wonderful man that ever lived kind of thing. And he played his part again, because Cervera is complimenting the Americans on their bravery, on their chivalry, in equal amounts. If either side had stopped that, there would have been a problem. But it's mutually reinforcing of the image the Navy wanted to share with the American public. They're in a battle for appropriations, as they always are with the Army. And the picking of the Naval Academy for where Cervera goes, not all the prisoners.
Right, but he and 40 of his officers were here.
Some of a handful were just regular sailors, but they were for servants, right? The bulk of them are the highest ranking officers. I think they had to leave a couple of officers with the men to lead them when they were taking a CV, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Island.
Why did they come to the Naval Academy?
All right, this is the part I want to know more about, and if anyone that listens to this can help me out, I'd appreciate it. But in all wars before this, the Navy would capture prisoners of war. Maybe the Army captures more, usually, but the Navy had in the Civil War, the Navy had in the War of 1812.
Right, and we had we have parole, which is part of Annapolis today. Parole was
that's for
was
Civil it, War,
was for
right.
Civil War, right?
Right, and from all I can tell, and that's what I want to know if anyone can show me differently, the usual procedure was that the Navy turned its prisoners of war when they could over to the Army. The Army's based on land. The Army has the facilities to have the prisoners. This war is the different one, unless someone can tell me that I'm wrong on this. But in 1898, the Army says, okay, we're ready to receive these prisoners. And the Navy says, we're not letting them go. And there's the bickering that starts about this, because you would think, well, why don't you leave them in Cuba? Because they're at Guantanamo Bay, you know, we had possession of that by that time. But there's a lot of yellow fever going on. There's problems. They're having trouble keeping their own people healthy. So that might be a reason. But I don't think so, because the Army is going to say to the Navy, you cannot take these people back to the United States. A number of them have yellow fever or malaria or whatever tropical illness that was going on. They did. They did have these diseases. And the Navy says, nope. And then the American city started saying, bring them here, bring them there. They all wanted these prisoners. Why? Not to treat them badly.
Celebrity.
Because they wanted to make them celebrities, or it's almost like a PR campaign. Hey, look at our city. We're great because we have them. The Navy sent them to the Naval Academy. Again, a limited number. They didn't have enough room for everybody. Students were gone for the summer, you know, so it was a good time. And in my opinion,
So they were in the what was then cadets. They weren't called midshipmen at that point.
Oh,
but they stayed. No,
yeah,
I'm sorry.
I
want to clarify for the audience. But the cadet quarters, that's where the Spanish officers.
Some did.
Stayed, right.
But Cervera and the higher ranking officers stayed on Buchanan Row, and not the superintendent's house, but the best house is below the superintendent's house. And so they had servants, they held parties, they went into Annapolis and were honored by the local citizens.
And they went unescorted into Annapolis because they were Catholic, and it's a bit of a side story, but we still have the promissory notes that those officers signed, or most of them did.
I've seen them, yeah.
To go to, because at that point, the Naval Academy did not have regular Catholic services. So the Spanish officers had requested that they go to St. Mary's, which is on the other side of town, maybe, what, eight or nine blocks from here.
Right.
And so that's what they did. They went into town on Sundays for several hours. Jim Cheevers, who was a longtime historian here for 50 years, relates a story that when the war ended and the officers came back to the academy, the women in town, their girlfriends, their wives, were speaking Spanish, because what would happen is the officers would come back and they would sit on the front porch, if you will, have tea with them, sit down, and then they just come back.
And the daughters of those officers that were away fell in love with the Spanish officers, and newspapers around the country were reporting what happened that day at the Naval Academy with these officers. So in some ways you could say it's showcasing the greatness of the cradle of naval aristocracy, I think was the term that was used, by having these people there. And yeah, they were unescorted, and they even went to Baltimore unescorted. And at one point, I think they had asked for permission each time. It was determined that the Spanish had to pay for their own transportation back to Spain. Somehow the army POWs didn't have to do that, because it was part of the peace treaty, but somehow that this was a loophole that didn't work out, so they were going to have to do it. So Severo was allowed to go on trains to New York City and different places to make arrangements. And everywhere he went, he's a hero. He's just
right. He's got this amazing following, because you've seen the letters that we have here in the museum. We've got a large storage area with manuscripts, but there are hundreds and hundreds of what we call today fan mail.
Right.
From average citizens to Severo.
Right. And so he is a hero. He's not worshipped in the same way Dewey was. There's not parades, but maybe there would have been, because some cities had invited him to come to a parade, but he didn't do it. But no, it was never at the level of Dewey or something, but he's a hero. But as each of the other American-born heroes is discredited for being selfish in some way, whether it's political aspirations or they're bickering with each other or kissing too many women, whatever it was, he's the only one left. And so the reason I started the project to begin with was that I came across an article as I was studying about Theodore Roosevelt's heroic nature and how it wasn't so high during the Spanish-American War. I came across an article in Life magazine in 1899 that said that Severo was the most durable hero of the war. And it went through and said that each of the American-born heroes had disgraced themselves in some way. And now we are left with Admiral Severo, a gallant, chivalrous gentleman that he is. And I thought, this makes no sense. That's why I started the project. I wanted to understand why they would say it. And my research showed that he held that status, which may have been more of a criticism of American officers more than a admiration of Severo. You know, there's a little bit of tongue-in-cheek there, maybe. But the public loved him, that's for sure. But that lasts until he dies in 1909. I may have that off by a year or so. But when he dies, World War I is not that far off. And this is the fascinating thing. I really want to do more work on this, is that in World War I, it was recognized by the Army that there can be the greatest hero of the war. It seems like people wanted to rank heroes. We don't really do that anymore, but there really was this need. And so they start predicting who would be the greatest hero of World War I. And the Pershing is insistent that it be a regular Army officer, not a volunteer. And so they start working to make, and I'm sorry, I don't remember the name. There was like three people that were candidates for it. People that had done something heroic in the nature of the war, they thought that would work. But so to create a hero, you have to have a cooperation or interaction with the media and the hero himself, usually, or a press agent, or an institution like the Army, we could say, that you're working back and forth. But it's democratic in the sense the people will reject it if they don't like it. They pick who their heroes are. So as they're trying to make these guys, and who really deserve to be remembered, and I really hate that I can't think of their names right now, be the hero, Sergeant York comes Alvin York, who is a volunteer, who was a pacifist, but he gets over that during the war, uneducated for the most part, and his heroism of capturing so many Germans is exaggerated greatly, but nonetheless, he did heroic things. But when that story gets out, the public grabs a hold of it and they won't let go of it, and Pershing even writes something about, oh my goodness, they're going to make this volunteer the hero of the war. So you see, in a sense, you need heroes to demonstrate your usefulness to the nation, and I would say appropriations are always attached to that somehow. And to make it the citizen soldier rather than the professional army force made it seem, this is my own thoughts here, that we don't have to overly professionalize our army, because the citizen soldiers are the ones that are really going to be the heroes. They don't need that much training. And of course, the army pulls their hair out about that.
Professor Lori Bogle, Department of History, United States Naval Academy. This has been an absolutely fantastic hour. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. Anytime.
And for our listeners, if you enjoyed this episode and other episodes, please leave some feedback on the whatever platform you're listening, and you all have a great day.
Preble Hall is in no way intended to reflect the official positions of the Department of the Navy or the Naval Academy.